For those of you who care to join us, will you join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance tonight. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. On Zoom, you can raise your hand and someone will chat with you. Anybody in the room? Yes. Sheila, welcome. Hey, Zach, welcome. Hi, John, welcome. Good to have you. Somebody has their hand raised. I can't see. Yes, please go ahead. Hi, Lauren, welcome. Anybody else? Okay. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that the book Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism based on simple actions. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA simple actions. This is the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Generally, the format of this meeting is an open big book step study. That is not what we are doing here tonight. We have a speaker, a gentleman caller from Raleigh, North Carolina, Jerry Weaver.
What's she calling me? Gentleman what? Gentleman caller? What was that? I missed. All right. I'm Jerry Weaver. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety dates, July the 2nd, 1989. I got a home group. My home group is a group called There Is a Solution. We meet in Holly Springs, North Carolina on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. It's a good group. They wrote a chapter about us in the big book. For those of you that have just finished the 13-week session there, there's a chapter in there called There's a Solution. They named the chapter after the group. It's a joke. It's all right. We'll laugh a little bit. Come on. Live a little. And I'm a guy that's grateful to be sober. I do have a sponsor. Been two things I've done ever since I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is I've had a home group and I've had a sponsor. And I've tried as best as I can to stay consistent and current with both. And it's two things that have enabled me to stay grounded and to stay connected to the solution, even when, you know, life has thrown me curveballs and I've been deep down in the valley. Sponsorship and home group have always been two things that have helped me. We drove in from Apex. Trey rode with me. I appreciate you riding with me, Trey. I'm a guy that's afraid to drive over bridges and tunnels and go through tunnels. Now I'll do it, but I feel like I'm gonna pass out. And I couldn't remember if we were gonna cross through tunnels or this is worthless information for you, but if we were gonna cross through some tunnels and bridges, but I remembered that we probably would. So I was hinting around to Trey that maybe he should start driving. And when I started mentioning tunnels, heck, he's more afraid than I am. So I was like, well, that ain't gonna work. So we came through the tunnel and turned the music up real loud and just kind of looked at each other while we were getting through it. So anyway, good to be here. I'm a guy that I could not stop drinking prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried lots of ways to quit. I tried lots of ways. More of it, it more looked like this is what I'm going to try these things to get my life in order. I didn't know I had alcoholism and I didn't know anything about that or didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew that my life was in shambles and I drank a lot. But I went and saw psychiatrists and churches, religion and reading books, shaved my head one time. Thought that was going to keep me sober. And I tried to have people hanging around with me all the time. I became a vegetarian and started doing yoga before everybody did that. And nothing worked at all. And one day I found myself in a detox without really knowing where I was at or what was wrong with me. And a guy came in and talked to me. And I know now he was from Alcoholics Anonymous, but he came in and he just did something that was very different than all the other people that tried to help me. He just talked about himself. And he talked about how he had drank and what had happened to him, how he felt, things that had happened to him. And it was very different. He never really asked me any questions or told me what he thought I ought to be doing. He didn't ask me how I was doing. None of that nonsense. He just talked about himself. I mean, it always cracks me up when you're like locked up or when you're in trouble. People say, how you doing? How the hell you think I'm doing? I mean, I'm sitting here in a funny blue outfit on suicide watch. Not doing really well. But what happened was there was an identification that I got from that guy by him just sharing his experience. And I knew that whatever he had and what he was talking about, that described me. And that identification is what gave me a little bit of hope that maybe my life could change and could amount to something. And the importance of identification in Alcoholics Anonymous, it can't be overstated. I mean, that without any identification, there can't be any recovery for an alcoholic. And the guy made a few other comments that I don't remember everything that he said and the whole discussion, but he told me that when I got better, he hoped that I would pass this on to other people. Had no idea what he was talking about when he said that, but he told me that I had a spiritual illness and that the only way to overcome that spiritual illness, if I had what he had, was through a spiritual solution. And that he point blank told me that I was probably going to have to come to believe in something other than myself and a power greater than myself if I was going to stay sober. I didn't understand what all that meant. If he would have asked me at that moment what I needed, or what I thought, I thank God he didn't, but if he had asked me what I thought I needed, it looked like what I needed, and my family probably would have said the same thing. It looked like what I needed was a job. I needed a place to stay. I didn't have either, but that those two things would fix a lot of stuff. And then if I could get a therapist and some medication, then that would be just trifecta. I mean, just, and I need my wife to come back. My wife was sleeping with my cousin and she wouldn't come back, and really just really messed with my self-esteem. And I was obsessed with that. And I need a lot of money. And it looks like that's a solution to alcoholism. Job, money, place to stay. Oh, and I need a car. I motor blowed up my 72 Beetle and I'm walking. And I need some, so I need the car to get back and forth to the job and to stalk my wife. And it's a trap for an alcoholic. And what I was told, that guy told me, was, hey, you need to leave all that stuff alone. You screwed all that up. That what you need to focus on is basically finding God and taking these steps and giving your life to Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to recover. And that as you recover, all those things that you're worried about will take care of themselves, or you'll be given a path to, to clean that up or rectify that, and things will come to you. It's hard to believe that when you're sitting in a detox and you can't get out and people are looking at you and you're not sure what's going to happen. You're already full of fear and anxious. And he also told me that if I would put half of the energy I did into drinking, if I'd put half that energy into staying sober, that I probably would make. And I don't know why I was raised to be a skeptic. I was raised to not believe anything anybody told you. And for some reason, I believed the guy. And I don't know why. And my experience has been that I was kind of immediately launched into the program through ideas of a home group and a sponsor, and that our solution is in the book that many of you are reading, I guess, or just finished. And that's how we get better, is by taking those simple actions in the book and something happens. And I did a third step at about a week sober. I did a fourth step and did a fifth step at about, I was about 5 weeks sober when I did a fifth step, and I started making amends at 7-8 weeks sober, and my life started to change. Now, when you hear AA speakers talking like that, it sounds like, man, everything was just wonderful and the lights came on. That ain't what happened. It was very slow progress. It sounds like it's well-ordered, but it wasn't. I did the best I could. I didn't say no. And I took those actions and things started to change. I was still full of fear and was still just scared to death. I don't think there was a morning in the first 2 or 3 years I was sober, I didn't wake up full of fear. But I would read a book and I would pray. I'd talk to someone in the program and I would get just enough strength to make it through the day. And so I'm a guy that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I practice Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. It's not a part of my life or something that I go to. Alcoholics Anonymous, it's my way of life. I didn't wake up this morning wondering what I'm supposed to do. I was very clear when I woke up this morning. I said a prayer, I meditated, and I asked God what I could do to be of service. Here I am. I grew up in a family of heavy drinkers, Northern Virginia. They drank bad. I mean, some of them are still drinking bad right now. But I saw what alcohol did to people. I saw it, damage relationships and cause people to fight. I didn't fully understand that as a kid, but I can remember it would just scare me. Now, I didn't know it at the time, but I mean, looking back, my parents were kind of cool. I mean, both of them heavy drinkers, and they would have these parties and people would come over. And my dad was a cool dude. He had this, back in the 70s, he had this big old curly fro and these pork chop sideburns, and he looked cool and he had tattoos. And back in the 70s, not everybody had tattoos. I mean, you either had been in the military or a biker or had been to prison if you had tattoos. He was all three, I think. And now we got babies coming out with pre-tattooed, it seems like. But he had these tattoos on his arm. He had this devil that was nice, had a tiger. He had this ribbon that said mom on it. And then he had this other ribbon with a lady's name on it that wasn't my mom's. And so I don't think anyone ever asked him who it was. It was just like, all right, well, we'll look out for Wilma. But they'd have these parties. It would be fun when they first started, but towards the end of the evening, people would start fighting. Guns might go off. Somebody would leave, and then you get a phone call that they just got locked up, and somebody would go get them and bring them. I mean, it would scare me. And I just like, man, I'm never going to do that stuff or be like that. And I think right after making those comments, I started drinking. I was 12 years old. I remember that night just like it was the night. And I started drinking old granddad whiskey. And prior to that moment, I was full of fear and doubt and confusion. And when I got that whiskey in me, it made me feel like I was the king. I mean, it gave me power, it changed everything. It essentially was a spiritual experience. And I woke up the next morning in a pile of vomit, couldn't remember everything that happened, had blacked out and was sick as a dog. And the first thought that came to my mind when I came to was, my God, I have got to do that again. There was no, I know some people will swear stuff off, but not me. I mean, I just knew that it was a solution. And it was either the next day or 2 days later, I drank again and drank some more of that whiskey. And the same thing happened. It made me feel like I was the man. I mean, I just, and I didn't get sick. And basically what happened to me was I certainly didn't drink every day from that point on, but my thinking and my life changed in that all I really wanted to do was drink. And not long after that, man, I discovered heavy metal music and strobe lights and girls and basements and it was just on. You'll hear people say that they didn't have any fun drinking, or you'll hear comments like their worst day sober is better than their best day drinking. That ain't true for me, man. I had some good days drinking. I've had some days drinking better than what the day was. I mean, if the truth was known, I remember coming to in a pool with a girl named Kim Sizek one night, about 14 years old. That was a pretty good day. But I had a lot of, I enjoyed drinking. I had a lot of fun. I got in a lot of trouble, but I'm a guy that loved getting into trouble. I love running from the law. I love getting locked up. I love the being the courage it gave me to mess with girls and to stand up to the bully and to you know, tackle any dare anybody gave me. And I just enjoyed all that. And what happened was I'm also a guy that doesn't have to drink to get into trouble. You'll hear people say that every time they drank, they didn't get in trouble, but every time they got in trouble, they were drinking. Not true. Me and Trey will probably get in trouble on the way home tonight. I just don't have to drink to get into trouble. Trouble just kind of, it finds me everywhere I go, it seems like. But I got into a lot of trouble and I got kicked out of the Fairfax County school system, was told not to come back. After that, I got kicked out of the Stafford County school system, was told not to come back. And I was labeled a juvenile delinquent at the age of 13. And my dad kept me out of trouble. I thank God for that today. But that got me to North Carolina, which is where all my dad's family's from. But I got in trouble there and I got charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill and assault on a police officer. And that's how I ended up in the Air Force. They they used to cut, I don't know if they do anymore. They used to cut deals, right? You go in the military, you get out of trouble. And the guy that was involved with those crimes, he pulled 2 years in prison. And I went to the Air Force, had just turned 18. I knew it was going to be the solution to all my problems. I know my mom was really hoping it was going to fix some things, and it didn't. I stayed sober through basic. And then when I got out of there, the first thing I did was I started right back drinking, and I started blacking out a lot. I started back getting into trouble. I'd wake up and not remember, you know, in funny places. I'd wake up with other people's clothes on. I'd wake up and, you know, see a guy with a broke nose or a busted eye, and I'll ask him what happened, and he says, "You don't remember." And, you know, I ended up getting a fight with him. I don't remember. I woke up one morning and I'm living in a dorm with 200 guys, and I wake up one morning with a bunch of, it's cold, this concrete floor kind of like this, and I'm in a bathroom in this dorm, but it's not my bathroom. And I'm looking around, and I'm dressed up in some women's clothing, and it wasn't that cool in the mid 80s. Now it'd be all right. But it's one of them times where you're glad you had a blackout because you don't want to know what happened. I mean, it's like, but things like this would happen and I wouldn't think much about it. It was just like, I thought everybody blacked out, couldn't remember what they did. And I would just kind of blow it off and just keep rolling. I got married. I'm a guy that I live in this fantasy world where I just think one day that things are just going to work out and I'm going to just, my ship's just going to come in and, you know, and I think if I can live in the right place or be with the right person or just change these things on the outside, that things are going to be different. And I got married. I mean, she was 19. I just turned 20. We had no business really getting married. I was drunker than a billy goat the day that we got married. And we got married in a Baptist church. And I often think about it, that the Baptist preacher that married us, I mean, he had to have known I was drunk. He married us. The only thing I can figure is maybe he was drunker than I was. And he was just, you know, getting on with it. But we spent our honeymoon at a place called the Shaggers. Now, it's a dance club. It's a beach music dance club. And, you know, most people go to the beach or to an island or somewhere, you know, nice for the honeymoon. We drove 8 miles to the Shaggers. And we ended up, I think one of us got into a fight. And I think we got maced and they kicked us out and woke up the next morning and we had rented this townhouse. I think she was upstairs and I was downstairs and the marriage went downhill from there. But I really thought that was going to like force me to be responsible and like teach me to do the right thing. And, you know, it didn't happen. What happened was it really started shining the light on my irresponsibility, trying to stay married and try to, you know, being a good husband. And I couldn't do either. And I was a terrible member of the Air Force, I was a terrible husband, I was a terrible member of the community. I had all these good intentions and would tell you stuff, but I never could do any of it, could do it. And her dad was the first person that ever really kind of confronted me. He didn't like the way things were going with the marriage, and I don't blame him. And he told me that he thought I ought to like look into my quitting drinking and slowing down. And I was like, man, there ain't nothing wrong with me. Best thing you can do is just leave me alone. And what happened was, I think he, looking back on it, he may have planted a seed, because I started trying to do the right thing and I couldn't. I started trying to slow down and I couldn't. And not long after that, me and a couple guys went on about a 10-day drunk, and we we just rode the roads. I don't know if people ride roads anymore. We would get in the car and we would just ride around for days, park out in the woods and sleep and go at it again. And we'd been out for about 10 days. And I'd convince these guys to drive up to Oxon Hill, Maryland with me to rob a guy. And now we're in Coates, North Carolina. It's about 3 hours from here. It's another couple hours up to Oxon Hill. And so we were going to drive about 300 miles to rob a guy. Now, we could rob several people right there where we were at without going to Oxon Hill, Maryland. It just seemed like a good idea. And we start leaving, and we get about 8 miles. And I start hearing these voices in my head telling me that, man, you need to get your life in order. Something bad's getting ready to happen. And I can't shut it off. Long story short, I stop at a convenience store and I get on a payphone. I call my younger brother, who has, he kept telling me things like, we're praying for you. If you ever need any help, give us a call. He was a member of this church. And so I called him and he's like, I've been expecting the call. And I ended up that morning going to church with him. Now you got to picture this. It's January the 1st, New Year's Day. It's just a great day to get your life in order. And I ditched these two guys and they're not real happy about it. Neither one of them have ever been out of the state. They're really excited about going to Maryland. And I go to church with my brother this morning and I got these pants on that are a good 4 inches too short. I got this old silk shirt on with the big collar. It's one of them old disco 70 shirts. And I don't know where it came from, but I walked into church with him that morning. People were looking at me and like, man, I'm in the world's up with this guy. And I sat through the service and they ended up having this altar call. And I went up in front of everybody and people prayed with me and they rubbed oil on my forehead and they did all kinds of stuff. And I'm crying in front of everybody. And I still don't really know what's wrong with me. And what happened was I left there that morning and they didn't tell me this, but what I thought I heard was, hey man, your life is just automatically going to get better after what you've done here this morning. And that's the delusion. And 3 days later, I'm drinking. And, you know, it's now looking back on it, they saved my life. I stayed involved with them for several months, just living a lie, absolute living a lie. And then I started blaming them for what was wrong with me. And what happened to me was I got suicidal. I started contemplating suicide. I thought that the world would be better off without me. I shaved my head around this same time. And I worked with a guy that drank like I did. And I came in to show up for roll call one morning. His head was shaved. And I was like, man, what's up with your head? He said he hooked up with his organization that believes that the problems of man stems from their hair. And that he didn't use program of action. It just sounds good in AA. But he said something like, what they do is they shave their hair off. And what that does, it signifies your old ideas going away or the old man dying. And when your hair grows back, you're kind of reborn and you get a new way to live. I was like, man, it's a true story. I need some of it. I said, I need some of that. I went home and shaved my head. And I looked like an idiot with a shaved head. And I stayed sober for about 3 days. And around that same time was when I started reading spiritual books and I started carrying a New Testament around with me and preaching to people at work. And I started listening to gospel music and I'd preach to people on break at work and tell them all these things they were doing wrong and that they needed to quit sinning and get their life in order. And then I would walk out in the parking lot and pop some Percocets and drink some of that vodka and then go back in and preach to them some more. Just complete delusion. And the whole time making promises to my wife that I can't keep, making promises to my family. And, you know, I'd make a promise like, hey, I'm going to go straight to work and come back, or I'm going to go to the store and come back. And I meant that. And invariably, every time I'd leave work, I'd stop at the convenience store or go to the barracks with the idea of just having a few and going home. And I would drink a few beers or take a few drinks and I'd be off to the races. The next thing you know, I may go home that night or it might be 2 or 3 days later, just depending on the circumstance. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I was a guy that really wanted to stop that behavior, but I didn't know how. And all these that I know now, these kind of stopgap measures, they don't last long. I had this dog that had mange. This is the second suicide attempt. I had this dog that had mange, and the vet had given us this poison to kill the mange on this dog. And I had this bright idea. This will confirm I'm not the smartest guy in the room tonight. So the vet had given me this poison to kill the mange on this dog. I had this idea that maybe it would kill a man if it killed mange. So I pulled some of it up into a syringe one night, and this was after, you know, several days of just lying to people. And I shot it up my arm, laid down on the floor of the house there, and went away from here for a little while. And really, I didn't write any notes or make any phone calls to anybody. I really wanted to die. I just thought that the world would be better off without me. I hated what I was doing to my family. And that led to being in the hospital for several days after that. It was just, it was a mess. My dad lied to the hospital, and I was still in the Air Force, and they took me to a civilian hospital, and my dad told him I was my brother, so the Air Force wouldn't find out about it. And so I'm checked into a hospital under my brother's name, and I get out. I think it was about 5 days I was in there. I get out, and I knew I would never go back to living that way after going through that experience. And I was out of the hospital just a couple of days. And the idea came to my mind that if I eat a Slim Jim and just buy 8 ounce Budweiser's instead of 12 or 16 ounces, that'd be different. And that's what I did. I stopped at the quick stop and bought me a spicy Slim Jim and an 8-pack of Budweiser ponies. And I was off to the races. Now I'm 8 days from trying to kill myself. I'm 3 days out of the hospital, and it devastated my family, devastated me. And none of that comes into my mind with sufficient amount of force to not take the first drink. That's the main dilemma of an alcoholic, is our problem centers in our mind, and that we have lost the power of choice. And that's what, I didn't know that then, but that's what that was, that there's no circumstances are going to stop me from drinking once that enters into my mind. And basically what happened was, I, not long after that, I got out of the Air Force, and my wife is gone, and I'm living in this house that we're getting ready to lose. It's infested with fleas. The motor had blown up in the 72 Volkswagen, and I'm living like an animal. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I'm just living like an animal, and I'm just doing things I never thought I would do. And I start getting paranoid, and I think everybody's out to get me. And I left the guy's house one morning to go write another bad check at a grocery store. And while I was walking down the road, best I can remember, it was about 6 a.m. and I started hearing those voices again saying, man, you need to get your life in order. You got to stop this nonsense. And I just turned 22 years old, and like this clarity came that your life shouldn't be ending. It should be starting. And I wanted to drink. I didn't want to drink. I wanted to die. I didn't want to die. And what happened was, I said, God, please help me. And I said, there's got to be something better than this. I can remember saying that out loud. And right after I said that prayer, I looked over, and there was this little house on the side of the road, and the front door was open. And I looked inside, and there was a lady sitting in a rocking chair, and our eyes like caught each other. And the next thing I know, I'm up on the front porch asking if I can use the phone. I can tell you, I wouldn't have done that. That wasn't me. And she said, yeah, come on in. I went in, and I called my dad, and I asked him if he'd come pick me up. That wasn't me. And he reluctantly came. His wife was in the background cussing at him. Well, she wasn't cussing at him, but she was telling him, hey, don't go pick him up. They're getting ready to go on a trip to the beach. She's nervous and resentment because I stole a car from her a few weeks before this. And she came out to go to work, and the car was gone. I always told her, I said, you shouldn't have left the key in it. But I've cleaned all that up now. But he came and he got me. And that kind of shut down some of the lies that I had been telling myself, that nobody cared, and, you know, that I'm different and all that stuff. Right when I got in the car with him, the first thing out of my mouth was, I need some help. And I had never said that before, like that. And that was not from pressure from anybody. There was no intervention. Nobody was telling me what to do or what not to do. That was a voluntary statement out of my mouth. I need help. And for some reason, he knew what to do. I ended up in that detox. And that's when that guy, now here's the funny thing about that is, so I was on the way to the grocery store to write a bad check. I ended up writing a bad check anyway. So I get to this detox, and this was these high dollar treatment centers were really big then. And this detox was, I know now, was connected to one of them. It cost about $50,000 to go through that treatment center, 89. And of course I didn't know any of that, but they asked me if I had insurance and if I had any money. I was like, well, sure, I got insurance. I've never had any insurance. Yeah, I got insurance and I got money. And I just made up an insurance number. And told them, and the company was legitimate because I'd seen commercials on TV, but the number was made up. And back then it took them 3 to 5 days to catch up to. The computers weren't quite as fast as they are nowadays. And I wrote them a check for $500 to get in. So that, they call that going any lengths. They admitted me, and they did some assessment. And I remember looking back on it. Here's the funny thing about the assessments. I told you got the truth, and I'm telling you the truth was not in me. I hadn't told anybody the truth ever. And he asked me questions and I just answered. And the guy came in and from AA not long after that. Now here's another funny thing. This is interesting because we tell people not to do this nowadays, but so I'm in detox and I'm on suicide watch. I'm wearing a funny blue outfit and somebody's watching. But they came in and I had been there for a while that morning and it was hours away from the last drink. But they came in and did another breathalyzer on me for some reason. And I remember now this ain't gonna impress anybody because I know some of y'all are really bad drinkers, but it registered 0.19. And it'd been hours, since I had drank anything. So I guess basically I'm still drunk. Well, right after they did the breathalyzer is when the guy from AA came in. So he basically 12-stepped me when I was drunk, changed my life. So something to think about there. And basically what happened was after he talked to me and, I knew that whatever he had was better than what I had. And consciously or subconsciously or something, I kind of made a decision internally that I was going to give a shot, whatever it was he did. And so I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I can tell you is all those things I thought I needed, right? I didn't get any of them back. My dad, I didn't have anywhere to live. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a vehicle. And for some reason, I didn't worry about any of this. I went to a meeting. I got a sponsor. I started taking the steps. And my dad gave me a place to stay temporarily. They opened up the front living room in their house, and they let me stay there. It was extremely uncomfortable and felt like I was walking on eggshells all the time, but I was grateful to have a place to stay. A guy took a risk on me and gave me a job. Another guy took a risk on me and gave me a car, told me I could use that car until I could pay him for it. I didn't ask for any of that stuff. It just kind of happened. I believe because I was trying to live different and praying and trying to do the right thing. And, the whole time I'm full of fear. Then they're telling me, hey, you got to go make amends. I'm about 8 weeks sober. I got warrants out for me. Matter of fact, I had a warrant out for me in Virginia Beach. Clean that one up later. But I had some that were local. And they're telling me I got to go down and turn myself in. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. Now, that doesn't make any sense. If there's a warrant out, it's up to them to come get you, right? I mean, you don't. Like, they got to find you. And these guys in AA are saying, no, you probably ought to maybe you ought to clean that up yourself. And man, you know what? I did. And it was scary. And it didn't quite go the way I wanted it to, but it worked out. And you know what? I stayed sober. And I don't know. I started doing the deal and I started going into detoxes. I'm sober 30 days and they're telling me, hey, you got to come with us to the mental health unit. And there was an AA meeting there. I started going into a prison at about 3 months sober. And what happened to me was when I started taking the simple action, not only did I change, but people around me even changed. And I started to realize that when I stopped playing games with my life and I stopped working angles and I stopped shucking and jiving and bojangling, that I actually got a different response. And that when I came from a position of trying to be honest and willing, that people to actually help me. And it was very different than what I experienced because I thought everybody was out to get me. I thought the world was a joke and I never really thought that anybody, cared about me and that everybody's, working an angle or doing something to manipulate you. I found out that my perception of life, my perception of people was completely off. And now here's a few things. So my wife didn't immediately come back. When I got sober, I'm like, man, she's going to come back. No doubt she's going to come back. And she did. And man, it really hurt my feelings. But I think she finally left my cousin alone, but then she moved on to some guy named Jungle. Now that's bad for your self-esteem. This is a Fabio looking dude with muscles. And he's a bouncer at this big club there. And man, I was just obsessed with that. If it hadn't been for men in AA and good groups, good meetings, Yeah, I might have a different story today, because I wanted to do some things to both of them. And I overstayed my welcome at my dad's house after a few months, and my stepmom was like, man, you got to get out of here. And I'm like, well, where am I going to go? Like, it was her problem. And now this is funny. So she owned a daycare, and I don't know why I'm telling this, but popped in my head. She's like, you can stay at the daycare. I'm like, well, okay. Now there's strict rules around daycares, right? So she says, the only thing is you got to be out by 6 a.m. and you can't come in until I think it was 6 or 7 at night. So when the kids aren't there, I'm like, okay, well, I think I can do that. And you're going to have to stay in the back room there. So I'm back in the back room where the infants are, and it smells like poopy baby diapers in there. And it's like, it's god awful. So I lived in the daycare. Now, here's the reason I went to daycare. It looked better than the halfway houses people were living in. And I'm like, man, I'd rather live with poopy diapers than with a bunch of guys. So I lived in the daycare for a little while. And around that same time, so my wife did come back. I was sober about 9 months. And somebody asked me about Tom Iverson earlier. A couple people did. Let me tell you a quick story of what happened to me. I was sober 9 months, around 9 months. And so at 9 months sober, I had taken all the steps. I was helping people. I'd already started sponsoring a couple of folks, and I'm still living in the daycare, and I'm driving a car that I ended up paying the guy $225 for this car. But I still owe money. And if it was just an outsider coming in and they would look at my life, I'm like, man, that dude's got a terrible life. But I was grateful, and I was somewhat happy to not be walking the streets and living the way that I was. But I went to a lot of meetings, and I would go to meetings, and this guy that I really looked up to relapsed. It scared me. And then I would go to other meetings, and people would say, well, I relapsed, and it really enhanced my recovery. I'd go to another meeting, and I'd talk to some friends, and they got all these problems going on. And I'm like, well, yeah, I hear that, but no, I'm in good shape. And they would like try to tell me that I'm not digging deep enough, or that maybe you need to go see somebody else. And it started scaring me. I'm like, man, maybe I need to relapse, or maybe I need to do something. And then this topped it off. This mental health unit that we're going to, there was a guy in there, and he had relapsed. I knew him from outside meetings, but he was there and he relapsed. And he was saying that relapse was a requirement. And I'm thinking, it sounds funny, but in my mind, I'm like, man, maybe I'm not digging deep enough. Maybe I'm missing something. I'm kind of grateful, and all these clowns aren't. What's going on? And I was sitting in a meeting one night on a Sunday night, about 9 months sober, wondering if I need to relapse or go get some outside help. And a guy walks in it's a decent sized speaker meeting. This dude walks in, he's dressed up, hair looks nice, kind of like mine. And the mange medication, if you did this. And I've never had the mange since then either. I forgot to tell you all that. But when he came in, he like lit the room up. The room like lit up, and he knew everybody, and he's getting around shaking people's hands and talking to people, and he's laughing and smiling. And of course, I'm getting a resentment, like, who's this dude think he is coming here talking to everybody and laughing and whatever. And here's what he did. He got up there. He was the speaker. He got up and he started his talk off by saying, he gave his sobriety date, February 2nd or February 3rd of 1957. So he'd been sober at that time, I don't know, 30 something years in 90. And he said he'd been sober since his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never heard anybody say that. And then he went on to say that he wasn't saying that to impress anybody or to separate himself from anybody or to feed his ego. He was saying that because he wanted people to know that what we can have in Alcoholics Anonymous is permanent recovery. He didn't say anything about staying sober a minute at a time or a day at a time. I understand that that's necessary time, but what he was talking about was permanent recovery, and that he didn't believe his disease was out in the bushes waiting for him. He didn't say anything. He didn't believe his disease was in the parking lot doing push-ups, going to get him when he got out of the meeting. And that he suffered from a spiritual illness, and that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had, and that he found what he found here was a permanent solution, and that it wasn't some kind of first aid kit for alcoholism. And it changed my life. it's one of those moments where it literally changed the direction of my life and my recovery. Because am I doing something wrong here, Amy? Okay. All right. Okay. She looked like she was coming to get me. I was like, dang, oh man. Like, you scared me. I'm still full of fear. Just hide it, boy. So anyway, so that's my message is that, I mean, I've been sober since my first meeting. I don't think it's because I've done anything special. I can tell you that I have, even through the craziest of times sober, I've tried to stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that kind of changed it just changed my attitude towards life and towards the program. And me, not long after that, I did get back together with my first wife. A couple of years later, we got divorced. She finally just decided that she liked other guys more than she liked me. And I was like, man, it's good to know that. Finally good to know that. And what happened to me was I went through at about 4 years sober after she left. And it really wasn't what I wanted. Looking back on it, it was the best for both of us. I started stealing money from work. Now, I don't recommend this at all. Seriously, I started creatively taking money from work, and I started just getting really conflicted about it. I would try to stop, and the more I tried to stop, the better I got at it. That's why we don't work on character defects, right? We try to practice doing the opposite of the character defect. The harder you work on being dishonest, the more dishonest you're going to become. At least that was my experience. And what happened to me was I'm 4 years sober, and I'm in as dark of a world as you can think of. And I start blaming other people. It's God's fault, her fault. They don't pay me enough. And one day I finally got honest with my sponsor. And when I told the truth, I started to become free of that. And I did what the book suggests. I took an inventory and looked at what I had done and where I was selfish and where I was dishonest. And my sponsor gave me some really crazy direction, I thought. He told me I had to go make an amends to my employer for stealing money. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And then I had already figured out how to pay the money back without anybody knowing about it. That seems like the solution. And he's like, didn't your wife leave you? I was like, yeah. You don't have any kids? I was like, no. I says, well, who's going to be harmed if you get locked up or lose your job? I guess nobody but me. And he told me that I needed to go file for separation. I was going to let that thing drag out and, you know, hope that she'd come back. And you know what? Here's what happened was I filed for separation, and I got through a divorce without any arguing or fighting. It was an amicable as it could be, not because of anything I'd done, but because of the power of prayer and because of actually utilizing somebody else's experience, which is one of the great gifts we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got some just wonderful people that are members that are willing to let us learn from their mistakes if we will, but sometimes we don't do that. But I got through that it went fine. I went back to my employer and turned myself in for stealing money. And people were praying for me when I had the meeting, and I knew I was going to get fired. I mean, I was pretty certain I was going to get fired, thought that they might even press charges. So, of course, in my mind, I'm going to get locked up. I've already, you know, named the day group that I'm going to start in there. And I've already figured out the name for the group. And, yeah, call it the breaking out group. And you know what? When I made the amends to the owner of the company, he looked at me and he thanked me for, you know, several years of hard work. And even though I was taking money, I did work hard. And It sounds kind of contradictory, but even through all that, I was still in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and was doing stuff to help people. But he looked at me and he said that he had been forgiven for worse. And of course, I'm thinking like, I wonder what he did. Right? He's like, man, oh, all right, Mike. And that the best thing to do would be to forget about this and move on. They had fired people for way less. I mean, you would never get away with anything like that today, probably. It was a large sum of money. And, you know, I learned a lot from that guy. He's a non-alcoholic. He practices spiritual principles just kind of naturally. And I paid the money back. It wasn't mine to keep. So I did pay the money back. And I had an experience where I actually a few weeks after that, I got a promotion. I don't know if that, I'm not telling you that you should never do anything like that without good guidance from a sponsor or somebody with experience. What happened to me was at about 5 years sober was I realized that what we have here is permanent and that Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. It's not a meeting. It's not something that I go to. That Alcoholics Anonymous is a set of spiritual principles that we're supposed to practice everywhere that we go. And I had always kind of knew that, but I fell short in practicing. And I know now that I stayed in a broken, unhealthy relationship completely out of fear, that I don't think I deserve anything better. I don't believe there's anything better for me. So I'll just settle for what I have, even though it's wrong and it doesn't feel. And I know today that all that is, it's lack of belief in a power greater than myself, that I lack fear. I'll give lip service to believing in God, but my actions don't live up to that. And I know today, if you want to know what you believe, watch what you do. And I stole money from work because I was afraid. I was afraid I wasn't going to get enough. I was afraid that, you know, that I'm not going to be provided for. So I got to make something happen. I've got to do this. And I don't believe that the power of God can help me with my finances, bottom line. And I remember after going through the separation and making the amends, and I had a conversation with my sponsor, and I remember this is another one of those moments that changed the course of my life, kind of like that talk Tom I gave that one time. But I told Paige, I was like, you know, there's not a whole lot written in the big book on step 6 and 7. Don't we need to, you know, read something else or go somewhere else or do something else? And he looked at me and he said, I'll never forget it. He said, Jerry, if there was more that you could do, there'd be more written. And that your job is basically to surrender and to give up. And if you surrender and you give up and you're truly willing to move on to something better, then God will heal you and the power to do the opposite and to act out differently will be provided for you. And that you don't need to read any books or go see anybody else, that a book's not going to make you not steal. He says, and you don't need a new pair of glasses or to drop any rocks or to none of that stuff. It's good material, but it will not make you change. And what I can tell you is he's right. And he basically looked at me and says, either you want to grow up and trust in God or you don't. And what happened to me was I realized that I need to get on with the business of living and that I need to bring God and the principles of the program into everything, not just something. And it changed. I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, I thought I was, but I went into a deeper surrender and a deeper relationship and started to truly understand that God is everything and that my job is to bring God into everything. And my life started to change. I stayed single for a little while. I got remarried and been remarried now for, I don't know, 25, 26 years. Got a good marriage. I've never tried to change my wife. I've never raised my hand to her or called her a nasty name. I've never cussed at her. I destroyed my first wife's spirit by the way I treated her. And because of the program and men in AA that have taught me different, I've not done that. That's not because of anything I've done. I believe that's the power of God. I stayed on that job for 24 years, went from sweeping the floors and stealing from them to being a president. And I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I've got no education. I managed a lot of stuff and was very fortunate and privileged, I guess, if you will. But what I started doing after that, about 5 years sober, was I started practicing the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous at work consciously. And I started taking God with me when I walked into the door and things changed. So I'll say that all said all that to say this, that, you know, today I do believe that God's everything, that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have given me a spiritual awakening to where I think different, act different, feel different than I used to. And when I got here, I was hoping just to, you know, get a little car and a job and my wife come back. And I've been given way more than that. I've been given the keys to the kingdom. And more importantly, I've been given a purpose to help other people. And, you know, prior to getting sober, I often wondered what things were about and why am I here? I think we all probably asked those questions. And it's very simple. Today, I know what my purpose is, right? My purpose is to just serve God and to try to help other people. And I do that as best as I can each day. and remember that the source of my power and the source of my life comes from the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciate y'all listening to me. God bless you.
Right on. All right, we're going to pass the baskets in accordance with the seventh tradition. Seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements?
We welcome
David, first 30 days. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Literature is available on the table over there. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AAs is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to any of us. If you are shy, what's happening? Oh, okay. All right, I'm off my roll. Okay, if you're shy and you don't want to talk to any of us, you can email us at info@simpleactions.net. Someone will get back to you. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Can we ask everyone to thank Jerry? Thanks to all who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, we will have a chance to say thank you again to Jerry. And Will has volunteered to come up and read the paragraphs on page 164.
Good evening. My name is Will. I'm alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Vision for you, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. So see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you. And
all right, for the first time in a really long time, we're going to stand up and circle up and hold hands.